Maybe it's because I was born and brought up near New York City, which has such a short attention span, but I find most speeches boring and most question and answer sessions much more interesting. So I like to keep my talks short and hope for a lot of questions and answers afterwards. I hope you'll cooperate. One of my favorite philosophers, Aristotle, is once reputed to have said to his class after giving a lecture on cosmology, "Are there any questions?" His class had no questions, so he said, "According to my lecture, in the cosmos, there are three species of intelligent life. There is the animal, there is the human, and there is the divine. Now, the feature that distinguishes the human from both the animal and the divine simultaneously is asking questions. Since animals know too little to ask questions, and gods know too much. Now, if you have no questions, shall I congratulate you upon having raised yourselves to the status of gods, or shall I insult you on having lowered yourselves to the status of beasts?" And then again he asked, "Are there any questions?" And they had some. So I won't have to tell that story or use that technique here. There will be plenty of questions afterwards. What I decided to do today is a bit unusual. A couple years ago, I gave a commencement address at the local seminary to a class of young priests. And I looked over it, and I said to myself, much of the things that I said to them, I would like to say to you. So I'm going to give it to you, as if you were seminarians, with only a few little emendations, usually about time, past versus present. Because what I want to say to you is the same sort of thing that I said to them. I want to, first of all, congratulate you on a magnificent thing that you have done in deciding to give your lives to Christ in His church. Now, I feel very much like a student who has been allowed to teach his teachers for one day. So the sheep now has an opportunity to bleat back to its shepherds. So this is seven bleats. My first bleat is a profound thank you. Thank you for freely choosing the astonishing vocation of giving up your life for the sheep, for people like me. You did not do this for yourself, certainly not for power or prestige or comfort or convenience, but because you saw and responded to the advertisement put out by the chief shepherd, the advertisement that reads, "Wanted, hands and feet and eyes and mouths for the body of Christ." You didn't do this for yourself. You didn't do it from yourself either. God did it in you and through you. This advertisement that you responded to was not designed to attract the thousands. It went on to say something like this: "The church does not need you, for the gates of hell itself cannot prevail against her. You are not the church's hope for the future. She is yours. She does not exist to radiate your contributions to the world. You exist to radiate hers. You are her radiators. If Abraham had not responded to God's invitation, God would have raised up another Abraham from the very stones. You are invited then, like Abraham, to leave your native home and pour out the water of your life into the desert sands, with nothing but God's promise and your faith in it to guide you." That's quite an advertisement. Thank you for responding to it. The church has done a lot of listening to the world lately, and this is good, for she is a body, and a body has ears as well as a mouth. It's good also because she is a doctor, and a doctor must listen to the problems of the patient. But your first patients are the sheep, the household of faith, especially the millions of very ordinary sheep who make very little noise, who seem quite sheepish, and who are not part of any one of a number of small but shrill, strident, visible, and vocal minorities. So I would like to speak to you on behalf of those ordinary sheep, the sheep you give your lives to. So my second bleat is a plea which I know you will continue to answer, as you have been answering. It concerns one of your vows. In some form or other, you have all vowed poverty and obedience, as well as chastity. These are three paradoxical vows. Poverty fills you with riches. Obedience fills you with freedom. and chastity fills you with fruitfulness. You take this third vow, chastity, because you marry the church. That is why you must be men, because the church is a woman. My plea concerns this vow. It is simply this. Be faithful. We, the laity, look to you as examples of faithfulness. Perhaps we should not do this, or perhaps we should, but in any case, we do. So please teach us to be faithful to our vows by being faithful to yours. There have been quite enough unfaithful shepherds around lately, and the sheep are quick enough to learn from them how seriously vows are to be taken. Our lives are strewn with the debris of broken vows, broken homes, broken hearts, broken lives, broken children. Thank you for promising to help tenderly mend this brokenness by toughly and unbrokenly holding to your vows till death. My third bleat is that you be ready to obey Scripture's command, to be ready to give a reason for the hope that is in you. We sheep come to you with hard questions, questions like these. Why should I go to church? I can lead a good life without it. How can I get my faith back? I can't become a child again. I'm constantly depressed. Give me one good reason not to end it all. I don't want this baby. I want an abortion. I don't give a damn what the church or anybody else says about it. We just can't live with each other anymore. Why shouldn't we get a divorce? How can I trust a God who took away from me the one I love the most? Why should we wait till we're married? We love each other now. You must have medicine for these ailments. No prepackaged set of words, ancient or modern, are enough. Neither the abstract profundities of scholastic metaphysics nor the unscholastic insipidities of modern pop psychology will do it. St. Paul says, the kingdom of God is not in words, but in power. Words that come only from other words have no power, but words that come from the holy silence in which dwells the Word, those words have power. The word of power is not an idea, it is a person. We need ultimately the one word, Jesus Christ. But no one can give what he does not have. So for our sakes, please be absolutely sure of Jesus Christ, that he is your Lord and God and Savior and friend and lover and sanctifier and guide, your all. Give your all to him, or you will ultimately have nothing to give to us. For ultimately, we want only him, if we only knew what we wanted. We don't want knowledge without him. That's only empty cleverness. We don't want service without him. That's only Martha's worried fussing. We don't even want love without him. That's only human feelings, something precious and beautiful, but ephemeral and unreliable, like a bubble or a rainbow, like the grass that springs up in the morning and withers in the evening. We will wither. You will wither. Only Jesus will never wither. So you must introduce us to Jesus. We don't ask that you be super saints, just that you be in love with Christ. Not that you be perfect, but that you be his. We'd rather have priests who were Christ's failures than those who were the world's successes. To all our agonizing questions, verbalized or unverbalized, we need one thing. Like Job, we need what Job got. He didn't get answers, but he got the answerer, the one before whose face the questions evaporate, like raindrops in the sun. We need to stand in the holy fire, and we need shepherds who will guide us to the holy fire. To that end, my fourth bleat is, teach us to pray. It's a need we rarely ask you in words, but don't believe us when we ask you only to run our bingo games and raffles. Don't even believe us when we ask you only to take care of our baptisms and weddings and funerals. If we dared, we'd say what was really on our hearts. Teach us to know God as Moses knew him, face to face. Moses' people pleaded with him not to let God speak to them face to face, but only through Moses. But I think there was something in their hearts, too, that asked for exactly the opposite. That something is the God-shaped vacuum in every human heart. Please teach us how to fill that hole with God, how to make friends with God, how to practice life's most beautiful and joyful art. We need you to practice it so that you can preach it, and we need you to preach it so that we can practice it. So, for us, please pray your hearts out. The fifth bleat concerns your role as teachers. We sheep have a problem, you see, especially here in America. We spend thousands of dollars a year on a thing called Catholic education, and then we often find that we have been victims of false advertising. We find that our children are simply not learning the faith, but various varieties of pablum instead. We find that in so-called Catholic colleges, when the faith in its full and robust form is mentioned, it is usually mentioned with sly, knowing winks. We do not ask for an inquisition against the sly, knowing winkers, but we do ask for the real thing. We ask that the capital C in Catholic not shrink to the small c, for we find that when that happens to Catholic, it also happens to Christ. You are angels. Angeloi, messengers of the good news, the Evangelium. Deliver it intact. Let it be said of you male men of God that neither rain nor sleet nor gloom of night nor even the spirit of the times could deter God's angels from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. You are signs to us. Be faithful signs of his words, even when you do not fully understand them, which is always. For if we do not even fully understand a gnat, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, how can we understand the maker of gnats? We do not need a gospel that is small enough to digest, but one that is big enough to lose ourselves in, give ourselves to, live in, poke around in, explore forever. So please do not bend, fold, staple, cut, whittle down, or mutilate the holy words. Do not exchange your birthright and ours for a mess of deliciously digestible political or psychological pottage. Don't do what Jesus' disciples tried to do and are still trying to do, stuff the infinite one into a set of human categories, left, right, centric, or eccentric. We are one in Christ, not in ideology. My sixth bleat concerns the only contact that many of us laymen and women have with you as our priests. The Mass, your primary reason for being. Here is a request you will probably never hear from a parishioner, but I think it is one of the most important things you can do for us. Always say the Mass with love and awe. Let us see that you adore Christ present there. Show us how to love the holy words. Treat them with wonder and worship as they deserve, so that we will long to come to this unthinkable holiness, to fondle and touch and reverently play with these precious jewels that adorn God's royal throne in our midst. We're all children, you see, and children are very good at reading between the lines, responding to tone of voice, getting the deeper unspoken message behind the words, body language. You can do much to get us to adore by adoring yourself. Finally, my seventh and last bleat is the shortest and simplest of all. Lead us home. We sheep follow our shepherds, and we want, above all, to go home. We're all E.T. No other word makes us so tearfully happy as that magical word, home. Home is where our heart is. You must be sure you know where home is, and you must be sure you know the way there. For we have been told by a million false guides, who speak to us with subtle voices from a thousand corners of our modern world, that this world is our home, and that the way is simply to be nice, or accept yourself as you are, or to have a nice day, or some other such inspiring trumpet blast. We need you to show and tell the astonishing truth that home is a person, our Father, and that the way there is a person, the Son, and that the only strength that suffices to move us along this way is also a person, the Spirit. Show us the Spirit, so that the Spirit can show us the Son, so that the Son can show us the Father. Be transparent windows to the triply holy light, so that we can see the light and find our way home when our Father calls us at the end of our day. Come now, my little one, it's time to put away your toys and come home. It's an enormous task, far too big for you. That's your only qualification for it, your inability, your smallness. Only the shoulders of a child can carry the awful and wonderful burden, the weight of glory. We ask of you nothing less than the absolutely impossible and absolutely necessary task of being to us little Christs, Christ's hands and feet, Christ's slaves. That's what St. Paul called himself. And for that, we love you and thank you from the heart of our heart and for all eternity. I warned you that would be short. But that was just priming the pump. Now comes the pump. To get into a swimming pool, you need a diving board. That was the diving board. Now comes the swimming pool.
To be a teacher, and to fulfill these bleeps, this pastor, I'll sit at a place like this, 2,000 miles from home, and I'll write down, well, I'm going to be better at the RCIA, or I'm going to be better in the school and get the true teaching across. The new catechism is coming out, so I'm going to organize the people. I'm going to develop small, basic Christian communities, and they're all going to study the catechism. And I start, and I just start naming things, and I start remembering, oh, these got to be in two languages, in English and Spanish. And then I get back home, I get off the airport, and I walk into the rectory, and there's 14 messages, and I say, oh, the hell with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do the baptisms, do the weddings, do the funerals, and answer the phone, and let God take care of the rest. And so it never gets around to doing, the things. I'd love to do all of them, but then there's that problem of logistics.
I have a sign on my refrigerator. It says, God put me on this earth to do a certain number of things. Right now, I am so far behind that I can never die. The mistake that we make almost all the time is to work from the outside in instead of from the inside out. Here are the things we have to do. A, B, C, D. Somehow or other, I'll get the power to do it. So let's concentrate on A, B, C, and D. That's like saying, I've got to get from Newark to Albany, so I've got to get a road map and be sure I take the best highway, but I forget to put gas in the car. I, too, increasingly have the problem of never catching up and being inundated with paperwork and responsibilities and a lot of stuff. Well, let me tell you from my own experience, almost always a negative one, but every once in a while a positive one, the biggest difference that anything makes to my life. If I get up in the morning, the first thing that happens is that I get attacked by 1,000 little midget soldiers with swords pricking it into my brain saying this, that, and the other thing today. I got to kill them. I got to be absolutely merciless. I got to say no, and then I got to pray. I find that the busier my day, the more I can't possibly afford to pass up time for prayer. Because if I do, then I don't get anything done. On the other hand, if for some, I don't know, I still don't know how this works. I know it's providence rather than miracle, but it seems like miracle. When and insofar as I kill those little soldiers and just turn to God and forget about time, and let him be there, then everything comes together. It's like the loaves and fishes. They symbolize a lot of things, but one of the things they symbolize is time. When we give our time to God, he magically multiplies it and gives it back to us. I think we all know that from experience. The principle is you got to work from the inside out. You got to plug in to the source of power before your appliances are going to work. Now, I'm notoriously bad at making appliances work or organizing things or solving problems like, how do you get your New Year's resolutions all taken care of? But at least I know enough to start with first things first.
I'm in a new parish now, not that new. I'm there almost 2 years. Then we have got this team ministry, there are 4 priests there and 2 nuns and 2 laymen. They have got a pastor's team meeting practically every week. We discuss, we talk, we speak. and we started a new program to get more people involved. And it's a large parish of 6,000 families. Hmm. All said and done, there are a few percentage of people involved in everything, but the rest of them kind of not working more, you know, so it's a scratch and kind of, I don't know. Because even though the parish belongs to everybody, but all are not there to carry the burden.
Yes.
Yep.
I think your parish is a symbol of the whole world. The church is never enough for the world. It's like a hospital where there's 1,000 people hurting and only a few doctors. That's the normal situation. Any situation different than that, any parish in which the supply and the demand is equal, is a very unusual parish. That's a bubble. That's not the world that Christ came into. He too had the same problem. How many blind men do you think there were in Israel? 10,000 maybe. How many did he heal? Dozen, couple dozen? How many actually heard him? Nobody is ever going to solve that problem until heaven. One of the most liberating things I've ever heard, especially when we worry about getting all this work done, which simply can't be done, is Mother Teresa's oft-quoted saying, God did not put me here to be successful. God put me here to be faithful. Gandhi said he learned something much like that from the Sermon on the Mount, and he also learned it from the Bhagavad Gita. The advice that you do your work not with hankering for the fruits. You don't do your work as a means to the end of completing it. You do your work because that's your job, because you have been sent there, because you have been commissioned, because your commanding officer has sent you there. In other words, you work from the back forward instead of from the front backwards. Instead of saying, I want to eat a delicious dinner full of potato salad, therefore I will peel these potatoes. You say, I will peel these potatoes because that is what I am supposed to do. It's a psychological difference. It's not a logistical difference. But I think the motivation that comes from simply obeying our commanding officer is much more effective than the motivation that comes from desiring success and closure and completion and fulfilling our tasks.
How do you respond to lay people or religious or clergy who are angry or hurt or disillusioned or disenchanted or bruised in any way by, quote, the church, unquote?
You take time with them, you listen to them, you talk to them, you love them, and you don't compromise either of our two absolutes, love or truth. It's you see, I'm a philosopher. It's easy for me to answer questions like that because I don't have to get down to the nitty-gritty and say, yeah, but what do you do when she says this or when he does that? I can tell you what you already know, abstract principles. But we have to be reminded of these things because we're so tempted to compromise either love or truth. Either to say, well, I don't really care about you. I've got too many things to do. I'm not going to listen. Or to say, well, I'll compromise a little bit in order to be well accepted. I'm not going to deliver God's full truth here. I'll make it a little more palatable. Those are two enormous temptations. It's very difficult not to succumb to either of them. But we have to not succumb to either of them. So what do you do with bitter people? It's the long haul, usually. That's a kind of healing. I know quite a few bitter people. That's a kind of healing that takes years.
Bitter lady.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The numbers differ in different places. But, yeah. But I think we have to realize that this bitterness is not natural. It's from propaganda. It's from the media. It's from our societies, from outside. We've got an immense advantage. God designed the human heart. And the heart's a homing pigeon in God's home. So we don't have to artificially inculcate or propagandize or impose some new burden on the heart. It's already in there. We just have to let it out.
always struck by that phrase you referred to as a scriptural phrase, be ready to give a reason for the hope that is within you. A practical matter, I'd like to know the focus of that, and on still more practical, I'd like you to role play.
Second Peter somewhere.
Apply that principle. Where?
Second Peter. I think Second Peter 1:16.
Why don't you try that now? Just pick a pastoral problem and role play. Say that you're a pastor, and then whatever the problem is that you suggest, that you're going to give a reason for the hope that lies within you relative to that problem.
Well, that's a challenge. All right, you give me the problem. Since you gave me the challenge, give me the problem too.
Suppose it were one of your students or a recent graduate, Catholic by birth, not practicing, wedding in the offing. No particular reason why this should be a church wedding. It would be nice to have a church wedding. But my intended is, say, a Methodist not working at it. I'm a Catholic by birth. I went to Boston College. I'm not working at it. I kind of like to have a church wedding, but I don't really see why it's such a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I'd say is you're absolutely right. You're consistent. Since you don't really understand what business the church is in, because if you understood that, you'd be a practicing Catholic, therefore, you're perfectly right in saying, well, why do I need the church's blessing on my marriage? The church is irrelevant to what you want to do. You just want to have a human relationship certified by the state. There's two different kinds of marriages. There's a church marriage and there's a state marriage. So I would first of all congratulate such a person on his clear thinking. And on his lack of hypocrisy. He doesn't want to pretend to be a practicing Catholic when he's not. And then I'd say, well, what business do you think the church is in? Is the church out to make money? Is it out to oppress people? Is it just hanging on to some old superstitions? Or do you think it might be in some other business? And do you think it might have something to do with marriage and love? And they probably wouldn't have time to go more deeply into it at that time, but I'd hope to plant some seeds that they might at a future time come back.
There's a door that's open there, though, when that happens. And you're right, I agree with what you say, but I wouldn't just say maybe they'll come back. I think even it might be an opportunity to have them as, quote, auditors in a marriage preparation program run under Catholic auspices.
Hmm.
Because something's there.
Hmm. That's right. Why are they coming to you?
Yeah.
It's like somebody who comes to you threatening suicide. Well, why'd you come to me? If you really want to do it, you just do it. So you don't really want to do it. So that's why you come to me.
You know, that's why I'm struck with that saying from Second Peter, that they may be looking for reasons. They're approaching you kind of on a natural plane, and you're responding on a natural plane.
Yep. I find the one thing that's very often done and never works in the long run is, how shall I put it? Well, the thing of compromise, toning down what you think is going to be offensive because you want them. Let's say the church teaches two things and you think they could buy thing A, but they'd never buy thing B. So you tone down or deny thing B in order to get them to deny thing A. It won't work. It's a package deal.
Presented it in such a way that to get like them to think about it, and
right.
I've never been heavy-handed.
Right.
I tried not to be,
right.
Unless I needed to be.
Right.
And I found that has worked. That when you said earlier today, when reasonable answers are given,
yep.
To good questions, that they do,
yep.
They do respond,
yep.
And they may go away thinking, and then come get mm-hmm. a telephone call later. Yeah, we'd like to continue on with this.
Mm-hmm.
And that to
be
very helpful. So it's not as much what you say, but it's important. It's not only what you say, but the way
you say it. Also how you say it. Oh, yeah. No, heavy-handedness is never necessary, unless you've got a desperate case. I don't think we would have St. Augustine as a saint had it not been for the gentleness of Ambrose. He says in the Confessions, at first I thought that he was teaching nothing but foolishness, but he was so loving and so wise that I kept coming back and back and listening.
You mentioned the word signs, that we are to be signs. Would you play that out just a little bit more? How do you see that?
Ooh, there's a whole world view in that word. Almost all ancient cultures saw things as signs. Everything had a built-in significance. Everything pointed beyond itself. Everything visible signified something invisible. Sometimes it was just a vague intuition. Sometimes it was an elaborately worked-out scheme. It differed from one culture or ideology to another. But the whole human race seemed at one time to have a sign-reading ability, or at least a proclivity to look for significance in things and people and events that people are suspicious of today. Now, one of the reasons I think why most Catholics do not understand the Church's stance on no priestesses is that they don't understand that this notion that a priest is a sign. They think, quite reasonably, if a priest is simply somebody who's doing a job, and if a woman can do the job as well as a man, why won't the Church allow women to do the job? It's functional. It's scientific. It's sort of material. If, on the other hand, a man is a sign, then what is he a sign of? One of the things that you are signs of is God's work. When you say, this is my body, you don't mean this is Father McCloskey's body. You mean this is God's body. And God incarnate deliberately designed to incarnate himself as a man. Now, there's some reason for that. There's at least some powerful, although not perfectly clear, significance to the fact that Jesus was male and the apostles were male. Now, I don't think we all need to have a clear, precise theological explanation of just why God did this and exactly what the significance is. If we had this proclivity to see a priest as a sign. But we don't. I don't know how to restore that. One of my most traumatic and unsuccessful attempts at teaching anything is a course in philosophy of human sexuality where I keep trying to use Christopher Derrick's book, Sex and Sacredness. The point of the book is first to make you a pagan before you make you a Catholic. That is, to first see that there is such a thing as the sacred, that some things are holy, that there is not just a special, but a sacred time and place and action, and that sex is one of these sacred things. Then, after the pre-evangelistic putting fertilizer into the ground and giving this sense of the sacred, then to Christianize it. To sacramentalize it. Well, the students get the second half of the book, but they don't get the first half. They're Christians without being pagans. They don't have this sense that even great things like sex and death are signs. Now, I wish I had a clear, neat, definite answer to the question, how can you click on the sign-reading ability in modern man's mind? I don't know. I really don't know. But at least we've got to be clear what we are. We are signs. We are, in the most obvious sense, advertisements. People look at you and say, ah, there goes the Church. So people still understand that. A representative. Just as a single American abroad acting like an ugly American symbolizes all Americans to the citizens of a foreign country. See, that's what all Americans are like. So someone who is a priest, a representative of the Church, symbolizes the Church. That in the most obvious sense.
In Luke's Gospel, Jesus uses for himself the metaphor of the mother hen with the chicks under her wing.
Yes. And therefore,
why would not a female sign of Christian service?
God has female attributes. And women perform distinctively female functions that are also signs of God's nature, yes. The priesthood, however, is not one of those functions. The priesthood's distinctive mark is the ability to consecrate, to turn the bread and wine into the body, the gendered body of Christ incarnate. That's a specific incarnate gendered thing. It's not a superiority. It's not a power trip. It's not that men are superior to women or rule women. A priest is not a ruler. A priest is a servant. It's just different. Just as men can't have babies.
Boy, are there ideological differences on all levels of the church.
Yeah. Some of them are healthy. There's always been theological controversy throughout church history, and God apparently doesn't want to resolve all of that controversy because the church makes official stances only on a very small, select number of crucial issues. So there's nothing wrong with controversy as long as it's not bitter and angry. But on this issue, at least, the church has spoken very clearly.
When you try to harness or even silence theological debate, that's dirty cool.
Well, I don't think we should silence debate. Simply to announce that this is the church's position is not to say we forbid you to speak contrarily. I think the truth gets clarified best in debate and dialogue. If for instance, I were the president of a Catholic university, I would regularly invite atheists and pro-choicers and anti-Catholic agitators to come and debate. I firmly believe in free speech and total openness. No, I don't want to restore anything like the Inquisition. But that's not because I don't believe that there is an objective truth. I believe that the objective truth comes out the clearest in debate. So my personal proclivity anyway, probably because I'm a philosophy teacher, is pastorally always to opt for openness. But this issue can also be healing in another way. Let me tell you a little incident. Maybe you'll understand this, maybe you won't. It must be about 20 years ago now. My son was 5 years old, and he fell deeply in love with a little Southern belle who had just moved in next door. And they walked to kindergarten together, and then to first grade. And she was, when they got into first grade, the teacher was trying to gently condition the kids out of what he thought were sexist attitudes and stereotypes. So one of the questions he asked the class was, what can a man do that a woman can't do? And of course, all the boys said, baseball player and doctor and astronaut. And he said, well, let's see. And they found books that showed that most doctors in the Soviet Union were women, and that the NASA was using a woman for an astronaut, and that there was no rule in the Major League Baseball that said that a woman can't play. And of course, the boys were shocked and surprised, and most of the girls were pleased. But this little Southern belle was a little different. She was a little bothered by this, and then one day she came to our house ready to walk to school with my son with the headlines in the paper, and it said, Pope Paul VI says, no women priests ever. She was very happy. She wasn't even Catholic. She said, now I got an answer to my teacher. Here's something that a man can do that a woman can't do. And now, she was so secure and pleased at having an answer to that question that I thought to myself, why is she so happy? First of all, she's not Catholic. Secondly, she's a woman. I think it's because it helped her to give her a sense of identity. Only if there's something you can't do, do you have an identity. If you could do everything, if you could be everybody, if you could live forever, if you could try out all possible roles, who would you be? Suppose you could live for a billion years on Earth. Suppose you could have sex change operations every year. Suppose you could be rich and then poor. Suppose you could get a personality transfusion. You'd be enormously confused. It's only limitation that provides drama to life. That's why the rich are so bored and kill themselves so alarmingly frequently. Because they have very few limitations to life. They can do anything. So I think a no, you can't do this. No, this is not you, this is so-and-so, is in general a good and healthy and necessary thing. Now, it's that principle which I find is usually, not always, but usually denied by the advocates of women's ordination. They don't say, yes, of course, a man and a woman are different. Yes, of course, there have to be things open to some and not another. However, the priesthood is not one of those things. They don't usually argue that way. If they argue that way, it would be a much more important and serious argument. But they usually argue by saying, no, freedom demands that everybody is open to everything, which I think is a very unhealthy principle. Limitation is the core of life. But if you want more about this, I'd recommend a little book called Women and the Priesthood, put out by Franciscan University Press, jointly authored by Alice van Hildebrand and some guy named Peter Kraft. It's a cheap little book that you can buy anywhere.
Doctor, would you feel that celibacy could only be established firmly upon a theology that is orthodox?
No, I don't think that. I think celibacy could be anchored in a purely pragmatic thing. Most governments want their spies to be celibate. First of all, so that they don't have families. Secondly, so that they don't have distractions.
Some ideas or something to be pondered upon.
Well, I think it's very clear in St. Paul. Now, he doesn't explicitly confine this to the priesthood, but he advised the Corinthians not to marry. Not to repress them, but in order to lift a burden from them. Now, that burden is usually interpreted in two ways. First of all, they're being persecuted. So if they married, they could have hostages. The emperor could make you blaspheme by torturing your wife, so don't have a wife. But also, secondly, worldly distractions, split loyalties, too many harries and hassles. Not lust, but worldliness seems to be the thing Paul worried about the most in marriage, and he wanted whoever he was writing to free from that. Now, it seems to me that that's still true, that it makes good practical sense for the church to demand celibacy. We also know that it's not necessary. The Eastern Church doesn't demand it, the early church didn't, and that may change. That's like Friday fasting. That's not a doctrine. That's a law, a pastoral practice. So it's not a matter of theological conviction. It's a matter, it seems to me, of practical utility.
From time to time in the Western Church, we have converted Anglican priests, married priests. And I'm just wondering, Doctor, in your own experience and observation, parish perhaps in your observation, that has a converted Anglican priest in family life and so on.
The two that I do know in that situation both do marvelously. They're both wonderful people. So I think it can be done. And I think it's done generally successfully in the Eastern Church. So that may come. But it's a little bit like translating the liturgy once again into another kind of English. Is the English language in such a wonderful state now that we want a new definitive translation, or is it in a pretty sick state? Well, what about marriage? Is marriage in such a wonderful state now that we need more of it in the priesthood, or is it in such a confused state that it would further confuse the priesthood? I think practically the answer is quite clear. But I would be, what do I know anyway about practical pastoral stuff? But you know, if I were Pope, great title for a book, the rest of the book is bound to be foolishness, I would deliberately cultivate areas of the church where that was done as an experiment to see how it worked. If it worked in the East, it might work in the West. I just don't know.
I have a question. I'm interested to hear your thoughts, as well as the audience. So it's about, I guess, the numbers of seminarians. I'm a layman. I teach philosophy here at the school of seminary. I'm interested to what you think, perhaps in the next 10 years, whether the number of American men coming to seminaries might increase or decrease, and why. Certainly the men here, probably, most of the men who come to the seminary come through a contact with some priest, and I'm sure you may have some sense of where you think there are a lot of men out there who who are interested in it or not, and why they might be hesitating, or whether you think they're not now hearing the call.
There's one very obvious answer to that question. If you look at success, if you look at which seminaries are bursting at the seams, and if you look at failure, which seminaries are closing, there's a very clear pattern. At least at this particular time and place, the Orthodox seminaries are bursting at the seams, and the liberal or modernist ones are closing their doors. Now, at different times in church history, I think we need to be tougher or tenderer. And I think that America has gone so off the deep end with tenderness that what we need is to put more spine back into the church. And I think young people are sensing that. So they're going into the tough seminaries, places like the Legionaries of Christ in Connecticut, which to most people's mind is maybe a little too tough, but they're swinging the pendulum. Way. So I guess the prescription for a skeleton would be to get some flesh, but the prescription for a jellyfish would be to get a backbone. That's one very obvious answer.
No doubt there is a pendulum swing, and I began to see it as I was coming out of seminary, that wonderful hotbed of whatever it is, the 23rd National Seminary in Western Massachusetts, just down the road from your teach, and I don't think it's anything for us to go apoplexy about, but balance coming back, which is just
better than balance, fullness, paradox, two halves. Yeah. But balance is good if it's a dynamic metaphor, like a dancer. I love that image of Chesterton in Orthodoxy, as the church as a chariot with her wild romantic ride along Rocky Mountain cliffs, teetering to one side and then to the other, but ever erect, and the sprawling heresies leaving in the dust. There's only one angle at which you can stand upright, many opposite angles at which you can fall. Yeah. Balance, that's good.
Continue this question. I see your point that if we had, well, let's say, more spine, the seminaries would attract more men. Is that your sense? If we had more seminaries that were more orthodox or more spine, is your image, do you think more men would be coming?
Yes, not just because they're men as distinct from women, but because they're human beings who want to dedicate themselves to something interesting. Pop psychology is boring. Turn the faith into pop psychology and you'll get only boring people that'll come into it. What's the fastest growing religion in the world today? Islam. Now, Islam is to my mind, a good example of a religion that's very tough, too skeletal, but at least they're very clear about where they are. Now, nature abhors a vacuum. And when we withdraw, they enter. Let me give you a little incident that typifies this. A couple of years ago, I was teaching a course at BC in the evening school. It's a three-hour session once a week, so it's a long class session, so I give them about a 20-minute break. So during the break, we were drinking Coke and eating potato chips, and there were about 20 of us. We were just having informal conversation. I was sitting at the desk listening to the students converse with each other. There was a Jew, a Muslim, and 18 Catholics in the class. And the Jew, he was wearing a yarmulke and a beard, pointed at the wall behind the desk where they had just done a paint job. And there was a faintly outlined cross behind the desk. He said, "What's that?" The Catholics explained, "We used to have crucifixes in the room, but we took them down. We didn't do a good job of painting them over." "Oh," said the Jew, "why did you take them down? Did the government pay you? Did you get more than 30 pieces of silver this time?" He had a great sense of humor. Some of the Catholics didn't even get the joke. They'd never written a 30 pieces of silver. But the Catholic explained, "Oh no, we took them down voluntarily because we wanted to be ecumenical. The Muslim said, excuse me, I do not understand the meaning of that word. What does that mean, please? Ecumenical. So my temptation was to barge in and give a correct definition, but fortunately I resisted it and let the Catholics take over. They said, oh, well, ecumenical means, you know, outreach and goodwill and openness and above all not offending people of other faiths. The Muslim said, you mean people like me, a Muslim? The Catholic said, yes, exactly. Well, said the Muslim, I am deeply offended. What? Said the Catholics. What do you mean? The Muslim said, you have just implicitly called me a bigot. No, you don't understand. Wait a minute, said the Muslim. If you came to a university in my country, he was a Palestinian, if there were, there are no Arab universities there, but if there were an Arab university there, and you saw quotations in Arabic from the Quran all over the place, would you be offended? Well, of course not, said the Catholics. That's because you're not a bigot, he said. Now, if I come to a Catholic school, you think I would be offended by seeing a Catholic symbol in a Catholic school? Only a bigot would be offended at that. So you've called me a bigot. So you've insulted me. He didn't let them go. He said, you Catholics believe that man's the Son of God, don't you? And the whole Catholic said, yes, we do. And the Muslim said, I don't think you really believe that. Because we don't believe he's the Son of God, but we believe he's a very great prophet. Probably the second greatest man who ever lived, next to Muhammad. But we don't believe he's the Son of God. Now, we also don't have pictures or statues. But if we did, even though we don't believe he's the Son of God, if we had a picture of him in our school, and some government soldier came in and made us take down that picture at the point of a gun, we'd refuse. We would die for him, because we believe in what he said. We believe he is Allah's prophet, and we would die for him before we would take him down. Now, you took him down voluntarily. So I think we are better Christians than you are. They had not a word to say. They were utterly quiet. Now, I think we can learn something from that.
Priest is a sign of God, a sign of Christ, the Church. I'm also conscious that to be a sign, the priest also is to be a credible sign in the world today. So he has to be faithful both to the gospel, but also in some ways to be credible in the contemporary world. Do you have any comments to make about that second part of what I say about the credibility of the sign of the priest in the world today? Because I'm sure myself that's a bit different from the type of sign of a generation ago.
I don't think that's something for us to worry about at all. I think we should worry about being readable, and I think we should worry about being lovable. But whether or not we're credible should depend on God rather than us. Now, we have to be readable. We have to translate our message into terms the world can understand. We can't be confusing. We also have to be lovable by loving. Everybody loves a lover. But the concern to be credible, the concern that we can be believed by the world, is something that I don't find anywhere in the New Testament. Jesus warned the disciples against many things. He didn't warn them about being incredible. Because what we have to say and do is, quite frankly, quite incredible. That this thing that looks like a wafer of bread is really the body of the incarnate God, that's incredible. That the God who has absolutely no needs and is utterly perfect loves us so much that he would bother arranging all of history to incarnate himself and then die for our sins, that's incredible. So I don't think we have to worry about whether it's credible. I think we have to worry about whether it's intelligible, understandable, readable, and whether it's said with genuine love and passion. But it seems to me credible is a diversion.
According to some of the surveys, there's a significant decline in the number of Catholics who believe in the real presence of Christ. What led up?
A lot of teachers who should have gotten the Millstone of the Month award, I guess, they weren't told. I think the survey was a little misleading because it wasn't so much that they disbelieved in it. It's simply that they didn't believe in it. And I think the main reason they didn't believe in it was that they were never taught it. I find at Boston College, which is a fairly elite college, getting the cream of the crop, that almost all the Catholic students that have had 12 or 15 years of CCD courses haven't the faintest idea about the nature of Christ, the doctrine of the Trinity, or even how to get to heaven. They don't know the basics. They're enormously confused. So I think it's been that catechesis has been simply an almost unmitigated disaster area. If they were heretics and dissenters, that would be one thing. Then you could argue with them. But they're just vague and confused most of the time, I think.
Have you seen the new catechism?
Not yet. I certainly hope so. And I am told by those who have seen it and whose judgment I trust that it's a masterpiece. It's clear. It's pastorally wonderful. It's unexceptionable. It's just what it should be.
Just listening to you about that question of the Holy Eucharist, back in one of the classrooms, at the parish there, there was an old book sitting on the shelf. It was used, I guess it must have been during the 70s, but I think it's still used some places today, preparing second graders for First Holy Communion. And you go through the first page and it says, Eucharist is family. The next page is, Eucharist is loving Jesus. And we go through all of these things, and at no point, you'd have to be, I look for, where does it say it's the body of Christ? There's nothing wrong with the book in the sense that it doesn't say anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't say anything.
Yeah, yeah. I have four kids. They're from 21 to 26. And they're still all practicing Catholics. They all went through CCD courses. And I looked at every textbook they ever had. And without a single exception, every textbook for every grade of every kid in all the years of CCD courses said absolutely nothing. I mean, it was zilch, zero. My son, who's not particularly holy, his real passion is baseball. He's a pilot. When he was about 10 or 12, I guess, said to me, Isn't there anything more interesting than this? There's got to be something more than that. So I looked around, and I couldn't find anything except the old Baltimore Catechism. So I gave him a copy. He paged through it, read every page. I saw in his room the pages were dog-eared. Now, this is a normal 12-year-old kid who's much more interested in the Baltimore Catechism than this stuff. It's just not feeding people. I don't think we should go back to the Baltimore Catechism. We've learned a lot since then, but the point is that there's nothing there. I know I don't want to gossip or tell horror stories or anything of the sort, but one of my good friends in the Boston area was teaching CCD and was dissatisfied with all the textbooks there, so she decided to Xerox out something herself. The pastor wouldn't let her do it because it was pre-Vatican II. Guess what she Xeroxed out? The Apostles' Creed. Now, that's not typical. I guess most pastors aren't that obtuse, but I hope. Well, we got to start all over again. That's exciting. It's like a first century church. We've got pagans to evangelize. That's exciting to me anyway. I love the underdog. And one of the reasons why a lot of Americans opposed the Vietnam War, other than ideological and political considerations, was that we were the rich fat cat capitalists with the big war machine, and Ho Chi Minh was the little underdog gorilla, and we Americans love to root for the underdog. Well, in the past, the church wasn't the underdog. It was in power. Now we're the underdogs. Now we're being trashed by the media. The word Christian, which used to be used as a meaningless compliment, is now used as an equally meaningless insult by the media. So we're back in a catacomb situation. That's great. We're the guerrillas now. We're North Vietnam. We're Ho Chi Minh. We're the revolutionaries. That's exciting. We've got to start in our own midst.
One of your leads was concerning the Mass. Could you say more about that? I guess I say this from the standpoint of having been in a number of parishes, it's
sometimes hard to get enough time as the celebrant for all the others who might be with you and around you as co or other important persons to this liturgy.
Let's talk for a minute about the connection between the Mass and time. The Mass does not take place in time. Time takes place in it. The time at which Mass is celebrated, let's say 10 o'clock Sunday morning, is a time determined by clocks, or by clocks as signs of how far the Earth is rotated on its axis or whatever. That's chronos. The Greeks had two different words for time. Chronos was the time that was measured by the meaningless motion of matter through space. Kairos, which was real time, was the time measured by meaning and purpose. That's human time. It is now time to get up from sleep. It is now time to die. It is now time to consecrate. That's Kairos. So, for the reason of Kairos, for purpose, for what's done there, for the significance, for the end of the content of what's happening at Mass, you need a certain amount of chronos. It takes 20 or 30 minutes to say a Mass. All right. So chronos is a means to the end of kairos, not vice versa. So when you say Mass, how shall I put it? The clock is like sound to a composer. He uses it, shapes it, takes as much of it as he wants for whatever he's writing, a string quartet or a symphony. He's not bound by time, he binds time. So it's simply a category confusion to think, I don't have enough time to say a reverent Mass. That's a category confusion. I mean, even if there's somebody knocking at the door, even if the soldiers are knocking at the door, saying, you get out of here by 10:30 or we'll shoot the church up. Let's take an extreme, ridiculous example. That does not determine what gets done and when. You're in a different time there. In illo tempore, in that time, the old Latin words at the beginning of the gospel, you're taken from the 20th century and put back into the first century. You become a contemporary with Christ. The Mass does that which has to be done, makes us contemporary with Christ. Here's Christ. He's another person. He lived in another time, 2,000 years ago, another place, the other side of the world, and here we are. We have to connect with him. It's not sufficient simply to think about him. We have to really connect with him. So either he has to come into our time, or we have to go into his time, or both. And for both of those things to happen, clock time does not have its dominion. Sacred time, a new kind of time, obtains. Same with space. When you enter the doors of the church, that's a sacred space. That's not simply so many feet of space dedicated to this particular purpose. Just as this room, let's say, is a room dedicated to the purpose of teaching. Whereas the baseball field is a place outside dedicated to the purpose of playing baseball. A church is different than that. It's not simply so many square feet of space which is reserved for the purpose of worship. It's sacred space. You become not only contemporary with Christ, but also co-spatially present with Christ in the Eucharist. So it's something like magic. It's not crude magic, it's not push-button magic, but it's supernatural. Now, if we realize that, even unconsciously, we're going to necessarily have a different attitude to the space and the time of the Mass. It's going to be a work of art, not a job. It's going to be more like making love than writing an exam.
What do you think of Opus Dei?
Don't know that much about it. Many of the Opus Dei people that I know are wonderful people. I've read reports about the secretiveness of the organization, especially in Spain, which makes me suspicious. But I don't know enough to say. But most of the Opus Dei priests that I know are wonderful people. That's all I can say.
Like one of the most fastest growing denominations in this country are the non-denominational churches. And I'm coming across more and more Catholics in hospitals that say no religious when they're asked what church or religious preference. If there's somehow a Catholic connection there, so they end up on the list, but with no local congregation, which is a different category, but no religious preference. And I'm just intrigued. I know of a situation right now where dating a gal could go down the altar and have some time about Catholic or Catholic education. The girlfriend baptized Catholic, that's about the end of it. No instruction, no nothing. In a non-denominational church. And he's gone several times and told me, he said, I wish there was more aliveness of our Catholic churches like there is in this particular.
Yeah.
Aliveness, death covers a whole multitude.
I know what you mean. Well, I get the image that these non-denominational churches are like a fire without a fireplace, and a Catholic church is often like a fireplace without a fire. So we need to learn from each other. I also know quite a remarkable number of very good Catholics today who left the church at a certain time, became members of non-denominational churches or evangelical or fundamentalist Protestant churches, discovered Jesus Christ there, and then were astonished to find that Christ was in the Catholic Church too and returned home. So in terms of God's plan, their leaving temporarily, like the prodigal son, was a good thing, although it certainly grieved the heart of the father. One thing I'm certain of is that God's battle strategy is radically changing in the last 30 or 40 years. Instead of Protestants over here, Catholics over here, each anathematizing each other and arguing with each other, the Civil War is at least very confused, if not ending, because there's a world war out there, and the forces of hell are rather more important than the forces of heresy.
Witness that Southern Baptists officially, publicly, letting the world know that they're talking to us for the last 23 years.
Oh, yes, yes. And that Catholic Evangelical Declaration published 2 months ago in First Things. I just 1 hour ago wrote a letter to a Southern Baptist seminary that invited me to be their lecturer, their speaker, saying something like, is this the first time you invited a Catholic to lecture at a Southern Baptist seminary?
Which one? Southwest, Southeast?
South, yeah, I don't know, I've got it in there.
Southeast and Louisville.
I don't even remember, but... it's going to be an exciting millennium, the next millennium. Don't know what's going to happen, but the battle is turning. The Pope's very optimistic, by the way. The youth. Well, they've got some passion. They're looking. One or two more questions. Supposed to go till 3:15.
Just a kind of a comment you were mentioning about being a guerrilla, you know. I come from an area that, in our county, we're 2% of the population, Catholics. It's a very strong, you know, evangelical fundamentalist, and they're constantly at people in the church here. But it really is uplifting to see the commitment come through with people. They know what they are.
Yep.
They may not have all the smarts from terms of being well educated in the faith, and there's a lot more that they need to learn. But often they'll come and ask.
Yep.
Well, what is it? Why do we hold this?
Yep.
You
know? Yep.
They're asking about purgatory. What is it? What is this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a thrill then to see that. You know, sometimes I feel really sad for them because it's hard. They feel at times embarrassed, or they feel challenged that they can't, they don't know what to answer. But still, you see that there's a real desire. I think that idea about being a guerrilla is
well, I think the natural situation for the church is some sort of diaspora situation. I'm tempted to romanticize the Middle Ages, Christendom, a Christian culture. I think that's a mistake. I think the Middle Ages are like America, a bubble, an artificial, artificially successful little bubble between two much more normal times. Just as we're tempted to romanticize the 50s, when the deepest worry of the typical American housewife was waxy yellow buildup instead of murders in the streets. We're in a normal time again. That was abnormal. So this guerrilla situation, this guerrilla warfare, that's normal. And strongest Catholics I've ever known, too, are always the ones in a minority. When I was at Yale graduate school, there was a lot of anti-Catholic bigotry there. And the Catholics were a small and beleaguered group, and they were the toughest, strongest, best group of Catholics I ever met.
The New York Times ran an article, six articles on the Catholic Church last month, on the front page. Final article.
Wonder what they said.
Something's good, something's negative, as usual. But in the final article, they talked about the influx of the lay people in positions of power in the Church, since we have such a shortage of priests, and that this would significantly change the hierarchical structure of the Church in the years ahead. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have any ideas on that.
Well, I think the New York Times tends to see everything in terms of politics and politics in terms of power. They certainly see the issue of the ordination of women in terms of power. They also see religion in terms of power because last year they ran an editorial apologizing for their anti-religious stance in years past, and now they actively support a religion. Guess which one? Wicca. Naturally. Well, the great advantage of Wicca is it gives you power. I know Wicca is not witchcraft and Satanism, literally, but the great appeal of real Satanism is precisely that, power. Now, I'm not suggesting the New York Times is Satanist or anything, but I'm suggesting that they're making a very foolish mistake when they think that the Church is in a power game or even a political game. They're using the wrong categories. It's true. This is the age of the laity. And the clergy is the first to admit it. But this no more means changing the structure of the Church than it means, changing the doctrine of the Church. It simply means that when the Romans die out, the barbarians come in and run the empire.
I would like to compliment you and thank you anyhow, because a few years ago, you know, what was coming out in the papers, the magazine, you know, it just made the Catholic faith look so terrible. And it was, you know, I was never shaky about my faith at all, but I just felt so bad. But I have to say that I came across some of the talks that you gave, some of the talks by Thomas Howard, some talks by Scott Hahn, and the basic thing that ran through was, what attracted you was, the truth was there, and it was solid, and it was unwavering, the truth stood.
There's only one honest reason why anyone ever should be a Catholic. It's the same reason why anyone should ever leave the Church. Truth. Thomas Aquinas says that if a Catholic believes that the Church does not teach the truth, then he should leave, because he commits the mortal sin of hypocrisy by remaining in. That's how important truth is. Well, that's an absolute. It's an old-fashioned and unpopular word, but those Catholics who say, here is the truth, have a passion which those who fudge and nuance and mumble simply don't have, and they're going to attract people. Doesn't have to be a hard, nasty, oppressive, limiting, inhuman kind of truth. Truth is freeing. It's a point of Veritatis Splendor. Beautiful encyclical. Beautiful title. The splendor of truth. Good to end on that word.